Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents N of One. One man's Harvard-documented remission of incurable cancer using only natural methods. By Glenn Sabin, with Dawn Lamon, M.D., M.P.H. Forward by Dean Ornish, M.D. Narrated by Charles Constant. Disclaimers. This book is presented for informational purposes only. Nothing in this book should be considered medical advice, and it should not be used as such. Furthermore, the information in this book is not warranted in any way as to accuracy, completeness, relevance to any condition you may have, or timeliness. You therefore must not use information in this book as an alternative to professional medical advice you personally obtain from your healthcare provider. Do not disregard, discontinue, or refuse any advice or treatment recommended by your healthcare professional based on information in this book. Using information from this book in lieu of medical advice could result in injury or death. If you have a medical condition or any concerns about your health, seek personal advice from a qualified medical professional immediately. This book is neither endorsed nor sponsored nor affiliated with Harvard Medical School or Harvard University. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. Robert Frost, 1874 to 1963. Foreword. This is an extraordinary book about one man's journey with cancer and the healing power of comprehensive lifestyle changes. However, let me say from the beginning that an optimal and responsible approach is to integrate the best of traditional and non-traditional approaches in health and healing, especially with cancer. It would be most unfortunate, even tragic, if listeners came away from this book believing that most cancers can be treated with lifestyle changes alone. Glenn was monitored at every step of the way by a Johns Hopkins oncologist, Dr. Bruce Kressel, a renowned leukemia specialist from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard, Dr. Lee Nadler, as well as a physician with special training in integrative oncology and lifestyle medicine, Dr. Keith Block. They had a clear understanding with Glenn that he would move forward with conventional medical treatments if needed. It's also worth pointing out that Glenn's cancer, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, is usually the least aggressive form of leukemia. More aggressive leukemias, when untreated by conventional means, are almost uniformly fatal within days, weeks, or months. In contrast, 85% of people with Glenn's condition, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, are alive 5 years after diagnosis. In fact, the course of CLL occasionally extends over decades, although statistically the average lifespan of those with CLL is shortened. Still, some with CLL, and this includes Glenn, have endured serious illness and hospitalization due to the disease. Thus, listeners who have other forms of leukemia or cancer, which are usually more aggressive, almost always benefit from integrating conventional approaches with lifestyle interventions such as Glenn describes in this book. That CLL comes in many subtypes, some indolent, some aggressive, some intermediate, is increasingly recognized because of new molecular diagnostic technologies. Using these tests helps physicians determine who might benefit most from new and promising treatments, such as the new targeted immunotherapies. At the same time that new strides are being made in the conventional treatment of CLL, Glenn Sabin's story is inspiring and illustrates the power of comprehensive lifestyle changes. During the past 40 years, my colleagues and I at the nonprofit Preventative Medicine Research Institute, in collaboration with leading medical institutions, have conducted a series of randomized controlled trials and other research studies proving the many benefits of comprehensive lifestyle changes. These include a whole foods, plant-based diet, naturally low in fat and refined carbohydrates, stress management techniques, including yoga and meditation, moderate exercise, such as walking, and social support and community, love and intimacy. In our research, we have used high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art scientific measures to prove the power of these simple, low-tech, and low-cost interventions. These randomized controlled trials and other studies have been published in the leading peer-reviewed medical and scientific journals. We proved, for the first time, that lifestyle changes alone can reverse the progression of even severe coronary heart disease. There was even more reversal after 5 years than after 1 year and 2.5 times fewer cardiac events. We also found that these lifestyle changes can often reverse type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol levels. My colleagues and I conducted a randomized controlled trial showing that these comprehensive lifestyle changes may slow, stop, or even reverse the progression of early-stage prostate cancer. Changing a lifestyle actually changes the expression of your genes, turning on genes that help keep you healthy, and turning off genes that promote heart disease, prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, and diabetes. Over 500 genes in only 3 months. Our genes are a predisposition, but our genes are not always our fate. Our research found that these diet and lifestyle changes may even lengthen telomeres, the ends of your chromosomes that control aging. As your telomeres get longer, your life gets longer, and the risk of premature death from a wide variety of conditions, including many forms of cancer, decreases. Glenn made many of these lifestyle changes as part of treating his CLL, as well as several supplements described in an open-access case report. He was first diagnosed with CLL at age 28 with an elevated white blood cell count, lymphocytosis, mild anemia, and an enlarged spleen, which was surgically removed. Over the next 2 decades, he suffered 2 symptomatic leukemia-related events. The first occurred 12 years after diagnosis, at age 40, when he developed fevers, night sweats, and moderate anemia. He was diagnosed with autoimmune hemolytic anemia, secondary to his leukemia. He declined conventional therapy in favor of comprehensive lifestyle changes and recovered from the autoimmune hemolytic anemia, though the underlying chronic lymphocytic leukemia remained evident. Over the second decade following his leukemia diagnosis, he developed abnormally high numbers of white blood cells, lymphocytes, in his bone marrow and then in his blood, with white blood cell counts rising to 55,000 per microliter, 5 to 10 times normal. In addition to lifestyle changes, he added supplements as described in the open access case report cited earlier. Over time, his white blood cell count returned to normal. His doctors would have added conventional treatments had this not occurred. 2 years later, at age 48, the peripheral blood and bone marrow were without molecular evidence of chronic lymphocytic leukemia or any malignancy. In addition to what he did, Glenn took an active role in his recovery and believed in the value of what he was doing, qualities which often enhance healing. At no point did he leave the oversight of conventional physicians. He consulted the medical literature and worked with preeminent experts at top cancer centers to get an accurate diagnosis. He was as proactive in undergoing ongoing testing and examinations as he was in implementing comprehensive lifestyle changes. He and his physicians kept up with the current standard of care treatment options and human clinical trials. Every patient, every person, is truly unique, an N of one, and healing can be different in each case. If you have been diagnosed with cancer or wish to avoid it, please take an active role with your doctors and explore the latest scientific evidence to design a treatment program that is right for you. Dean Ornish, MD, founder and president, Preventative Medicine Research Institute, clinical professor of medicine, University of California, San Francisco, author, The Spectrum and Dr. Dean Ornish's Program for Reversing Heart Disease, Ornish.com. Preface. One summer afternoon in 2011, I read a short blog post by Glenn Sabin. Immediately, I picked up the phone and called him. The post had mentioned, briefly, his then-partial success using unconventional treatment to hold his chronic lymphocytic leukemia at bay. My purpose in calling was to prove to myself that Glenn's story was too good to be true. Many times I'd encountered similar reports. These invariably collapsed under slight scrutiny. Usually the patient had a lump or a suspicious shadow on an X-ray, but the lump or shadow had never been biopsied, and so the diagnosis of cancer could not be confirmed. Another common scenario involved someone diagnosed with cancer and treated with conventional therapies known to be effective, but recovery was nevertheless attributed to some non-conventional modality also employed. To my surprise, Glenn's case was solid. Glenn had documentation of his diagnosis from several respected medical institutions, the National Cancer Institute, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and George Washington University. He had copies of his pathology and blood test reports. He had letters from his physicians exclaiming surprise at his recovery, despite his refusal of conventional treatment. Glenn's story was the real deal. That initial phone call lasted 2 hours. "You're going to write a book about this, aren't you?" I asked him just before hanging up. "No," Glenn replied. "Too much work." "But you have to," I said. "The world needs your story." Glenn balked, so I simply repeated myself many times. I am not particularly skilled at persuasion. Under my onslaught, he finally acquiesced. But under one condition: we would pair up to get the job done. He would present me with 60,000 words of recalled conversations and events. I would formulate these into a coherent narrative of his 20-year struggle with cancer. I would record hours of interviews with Glenn and his wife Linda, and pore over the transcripts. I would interview Glenn's doctors and mentors. Together, Glenn and I would organize his huge stack of blood test results, medical records, and biopsy and scan reports, 20 years' worth. Glenn is charming and persuasive. Coming from him, the plan sounded straightforward, pleasant even, and I heard myself enthusiastically agreeing. I quickly set aside several hours a day for a 30-day period to accomplish the task. That 30-day task lasted 4 years, during which Glenn endured a major setback to his health. I was honored to be allowed to witness what transpired next. The surprising way Glenn approached that setback and overcame it beyond anyone's wildest dreams will forever change how physicians and patients view some cancers. It certainly changed my perspective. This book is offered with humility. Cancer is a formidable opponent. Not all patients will fare as well as Glenn has, despite all attempts to recover. Furthermore, it's important to point out that the reasons for Glenn's recovery remain unclear. Glenn is very proactive, and it may very well be that his unconventional treatment program resulted in his recovery. But just as an unknown event triggered Glenn's disease in the first place, might another unknown event have resulted in its remission? An event that had nothing to do with Glenn's actions. After all, association is not causation. Glenn's story is offered not to answer such questions, but to ask them. Perhaps this book will wedge itself into the cracks in current thinking about cancer and widen them a bit. If so, it will have done its duty. Dawn Lemon, M.D., M.P.H. Introduction. When I was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia in 1991, most doctors would have said that modern medicine had no cure. Most doctors believed then that finding effective cancer treatments required huge sums of money to be spent on randomized controlled trials in which expensive pharmaceuticals, many with harsh side effects, are tested on numerous human subjects over many years. Such undertakings require the concerted efforts of exquisitely trained, well-funded, and very persistent scientists. Most doctors believed then that nothing I could do for myself would help me survive leukemia. Although diet, supplements, and exercise, the pursuit of good health, might make my body stronger, my lifestyle choices would have no effect on the leukemia and would therefore be a waste of time and money. In 1991, most doctors would have said that there was no way I could successfully treat my own cancer at home. It is now 2016, and I am alive. And although I am well, very well indeed, many physicians still say that a patient cannot successfully treat cancer at home. However, perhaps it can be done. Perhaps I have done it. I don't know. This book is my story, and it is above all the story of an experiment. As an experimenter, I have cataloged my failures as well as my successes, in hopes that interested listeners might find some instruction in both. Finally, let me explain how I chose the title of this book, N of One. In an experiment, the number of subjects is represented by the symbol N. So a typical large clinical trial enrolling 1,000 subjects would be described as having an N of 1,000. My experiment had only one subject, me. Therefore, my study had an N of one. Glenn Sabin. Part 1. Death Sentence. 1. Someone was calling from the doctor's office to apologize. Would I mind coming in for another blood draw? I didn't mind a bit. I assumed that the samples had been lost or damaged. It was September 1991, and I was 28. The call from the doctor's office was a great excuse to hop into my 67 Pontiac GTO, my goat, and cruise back to the lab. After giving the blood samples, I didn't give my upcoming checkup a second thought. A few days later, I woke up charged, ready to blast through the day. The annual checkup barely registered. It was routine maintenance, the last on a long list of errands I planned to check off. How the Redskins would fare that season concerned me more. I kissed my bride Linda goodbye and hopped into the goat. With the top down, I roared out of the driveway into a blue and glorious day. We lived in Silver Spring, a Maryland suburb of Washington, D.C., a place where fall is world-class gorgeous. Past verdant lawns I sped, the sun on my face and the wind in my hair. My health status? Simply not on my radar. I'd skipped breakfast, knowing that somewhere between a haircut and the dentist, I'd snag an oversized convenience store coffee and a package of pastries, which in those days probably meant something with a decades-long shelf life. Next, the goat would get an oil change. Then came the physical, and if the doc was actually on schedule, I'd be out of there in time to swing by the house, pick up Jazz, our miniature schnauzer, and head for Sligo Creek Park. For an hour, maybe two, my canine buddy and I would amble through the woods, covering as much of the 7-mile trail as we could before getting home in time for dinner. That was my plan. My whole life, I've made lots of plans, and even as I was driving to my medical appointment, there were many important plans in the works. I probably even had something planned when Linda and I met at a Jewish summer camp when we were 5 or 6 years old, because now she was my wife of 2 years. I'd always planned to stay close to my family, so Linda and I were remodeling our house near the neighborhood where I'd grown up. The remodel was stressful and fraught with the usual delays and cost overruns, but I was proud of the results. A stylish and comfortable home, exactly as planned. And though we hadn't set any dates, eventually we planned to have children. I appreciate the finer things in life, so it's lucky I enjoy working hard for a living. I planned to earn enough for a lifestyle that Linda and I could enjoy. In service of that plan, it wasn't unusual for me to put in long days at the media company my father had founded. Shortly after I got married, my father's health had begun to fail, and I found myself running more and more of the operation. I drove myself hard, and I thrived. I loved planning and pushing the business to new heights. Competition stoked me, and the media business let me hang out with musicians and hear lots of great jazz. Despite my long work days, I did not neglect my body. Exercise was planned into my schedule. I worked out almost every day, usually lifting weights. I snuck in occasional unplanned cardio. Exercise was my stress relief, and like my approach to everything, I pushed it. I honestly can't recall being fatigued at that time. I felt like a tank, indestructible. So when I showed up at the doctor's office for my routine maintenance, I expected that last errand of the day to end with a nice slap on the back and a "see you next year." Instead, the doctor came into the exam room wearing an uncharacteristically solemn expression. "My blood tests showed a problem," he told me. "Something serious. Really serious." So serious, in fact, he had already spoken with my father, whom he'd known for 2 decades. It turned out that my original blood samples were not lost or damaged, but abnormal. The doctor had repeated the tests, thinking there must have been an error. There was no lab error. The abnormal results were real. "I had a disease," he said. "Leukemia." He looked me in the eye. The disease was fatal. With that news, every plan I had ever made evaporated into thin air. 2. Over 25 years have passed since that moment in 1991 when I began my cancer journey. I think time has dimmed my memory of that first doctor's appointment, the one that was supposed to be routine maintenance. Or perhaps what the doctor had to say had always been too difficult to absorb. I do recall him explaining that I had a blood disorder. It was called chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It was a malignancy, he said, a cancer. Next came something about needing to confirm the diagnosis with a specialist, then a bit of talk about scheduling more tests. Those details are now only a blur in my mind. I vaguely remember stumbling out of the doctor's office and into the lobby. Somewhere I found a payphone. I called home. All Linda could decipher from my incoherent stream of words was that something was very, very wrong. She jumped into her car and sped toward the doctor's office. Linda found me in the underground parking garage, pacing, weeping, beside myself. I slid into the passenger seat of her car, and Linda turned off the engine. Once I'd gathered myself a little, I managed to tell Linda as much as I could fathom of our predicament. "I have leukemia. I have to see a specialist. I am going to die." Linda turned the ignition key, and slowly she maneuvered out of the parking garage. "No," she said, "you're not." 3. Back then, what I didn't know about leukemia was epic. My grandfather had had a strangely named disease called hairy cell leukemia and had been treated at the National Institutes of Health. Sadly, he had died from the condition. That all happened before I was born. Other than a bit of family history, my main exposure to the word leukemia had been from newspaper and magazine articles, the ones featuring a photo of a cute kid who had lost their hair and needed donations to cover expensive treatments. I felt sorry for these kids, so I gave what I could. But leukemia, whatever that was, evaporated from my mind immediately afterward. After my diagnosis, I holed up in my study with books on cancer. What I learned from slogging through the chapters on leukemia was that there is no single disease called leukemia. In fact, dozens of different blood cancers fall into this category. Each of these leukemia subtypes presents with different signs and symptoms, requires a unique treatment approach, and has a different prognosis. I also learned that the two major subtypes of leukemia are acute and chronic. Mine was chronic. At first, that reassured me because chronic did not sound as serious as acute, but as I read, I got some very bad news. From the textbook descriptions, it was clear that the kids on fund drive posters usually have one of the acute leukemias. Although acute sounded pretty terrifying, I forced myself to read more. What I read was that acute leukemias are the wildfires of oncology, and they can kill within days. The signs and symptoms are anything but subtle. Raging fevers, bleeding gums, and deep bruises after the mildest bump. The symptoms bring normal routines to a halt, turning person into patient almost instantly. Well, at least acute leukemia wasn't me. I felt really healthy and well. In fact, I felt great. Relieved, I kept reading, moving on to the sections on chronic leukemias. What I learned was that chronic leukemias often tiptoe into one's life. At first, there may be only a slightly diminished life spark, a change initially ascribed to laziness or to waning youth. More often, there are no symptoms at all. The only clue that something is wrong is an abnormal blood test. This was sure sounding like me. I perked up when I read some good news. With swift and proper treatment, acute leukemias could often be cured. In fact, most children with the disease were cured. The procedure that accomplished this was called a bone marrow transplant. Whatever a bone marrow transplant was, it sounded gruesome. But I reminded myself I didn't have acute leukemia. I had the chronic variety. No bone marrow transplants in my future. Relieved, I settled back into my chair and read on. That was when I came to the bad news. The lack of severe symptoms, at first, doesn't make chronic leukemia a non-problem. Chronic leukemias kill as surely as acute leukemias do. What is different is that in cases of chronic leukemia, death ambles in at a leisurely pace, usually over several years. Treatment could control some of the symptoms of chronic leukemias, but there was no cure. None. In 1991, when I was diagnosed, every case of chronic leukemia was fatal. That was what I had, chronic leukemia. Specifically, I had chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL, the always fatal kind. I was doomed. 4. My family doctor referred me to a hematologist. His name was Dr. Bruce Kressel. When we first met, soon after my annual checkup, his gentle demeanor immediately put me at ease. He examined me thoroughly, noted a subtle swelling in my upper abdomen, and then explained that to confirm the diagnosis of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, he would need to do a bone marrow biopsy. A bone marrow biopsy is considered to be one of the most painful diagnostic procedures. The bone itself cannot be anesthetized, and only the surrounding tissue can be numbed. On an exam table in Dr. Kressel's office, I lay on my stomach and tried to prepare myself. A nurse offered comfort while Dr. Kressel inserted a thick, hollow needle deep into my hip bone and removed a speck of fatty marrow. It hurt a lot, but that pain was nothing compared to the agony of the week-long wait for results. The results were no surprise. My marrow was full of leukemic white blood cells. It was another gorgeous fall afternoon in Washington, D.C., when Linda, my parents, and I went to Dr. Kressel's office for a long and very unpleasant talk. 5. I was surprised to hear that I needed an operation for a blood problem. My predicament, as I understood it then, went something like this. Healthy bone marrow produces three types of blood cells: red corpuscles, white blood cells, and platelets, all in particular amounts at particular ratios. In contrast, although my marrow was still producing most of its allotment of normal cells, at the same time it was also pumping 10 times more cancerous lymphocytes into my bloodstream every day. Lymphocytes are a subset of white blood cells. They are part of the immune system and help the body fight infection. But cancerous lymphocytes function poorly or not at all. Despite this, my marrow insisted on manufacturing these useless cells in such massive amounts that their sheer number were damaging the rest of my body. The unceasing production of abnormal cells is a hallmark of cancer. The body makes attempts to control the disease, but when these attempts fail or are overwhelmed, symptoms occur. In my case, the leukemic cells had lodged in and overwhelmed my spleen. My spleen was so enlarged, Dr. Kressel could easily palpate it, a firm mass distending the upper part of my abdomen. When he pointed this out, initially I was relieved, because I thought I was simply getting fat from Linda's fabulous cooking, despite all my hours at the gym. The normal spleen hides behind the lower left ribs, far from an examining hand. Its duties include the sequestering of aging and damaged blood cells, dismantling these cells and sending their building blocks, amino acids, sugars, and fats, back into the bloodstream for recycling. A healthy spleen weighs only 2 pounds. Mine weighed 7. It was packed with 5 pounds of leukemic cells. Not only was my spleen no longer functioning, it was fragile. It could rupture and cause me to bleed to death. Dr. Kressel said it had to come out, and soon. Once that surgery was done, he said, I might want to consider a bone marrow transplant. I knew nothing about bone marrow transplants. Transplanting anything sounded pretty drastic to me. I asked if there was any other option. There was. This option was called watchful waiting. Watchful? Waiting? Waiting for what? Illness? Death? That option sounded even less appealing than a bone marrow transplant. What watchful waiting meant was that Dr. Kressel would see me every 3 months, keeping an eye out for trouble. What kind of trouble? Patients with CLL typically develop a variety of problems: swollen lymph nodes, anemia, bleeding, blood clots, fevers, infections, or crippling fatigue. Dr. Kressel explained that when problems eventually arose, I could expect to be treated with chemotherapy or radiation. These treatments would be given in small doses, just enough to ameliorate the symptoms. Submitting to treatment only when symptoms arose? That sounded good to me, until Dr. Kressel explained that these treatments would not cure me. They would not even prolong my life. All that any such treatment could accomplish was to ease the discomfort the disease caused. That was the most I could look forward to. By that time, I understood from my own reading what Dr. Krussel was trying to tell me. CLL was incurable, and eventually it was likely to kill me. Had it been a
Sample complete. Ready to continue?